Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, good friends. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving with your friends and family. And now, since all of our regular roundtable guests are off celebrating the long Thanksgiving holiday with their own loved ones, we bring you a very different kind of podcast today. Very different and very special because it takes us away from all of the contentious politics of the day and into the fascinating world of shipwrecks. Yes, shipwrecks. The most famous shipwreck of all, of course, remains the Titanic. Remarkable because it was the maiden voyage of what had been billed as the unsinkable new ocean liner. But the Titanic's only one of thousands and thousands of shipwrecks, many of them also famous, and hundreds of which, despite new construction materials and new technology, still happen every year. Which raises all kinds of questions about whether they can be salvaged, whether survivors or their families of victims are compensated, and who pays for any environmental damage. It's all the subject of a fascinating new book called Sinkable, the latest book from best-selling author Daniel Stone. Daniel Stone, good to talk to you, and welcome to the Bill Press Pod.
What a joy to be with you.
Thank you. All right, your new book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. I loved it. I learned a lot from it. I was so impressed with your encyclopedic knowledge of shipwrecks throughout history around the world, especially revolving around the Titanic, of course. So congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
But I have to say, so I finished the book, and then the next day, I pick up the New York Times, and there's an article in it about people today who pay $250,000 to go down in a submersible 2.4 miles to get a good look up close of the wreck of the Titanic. Daniel, this happened 110 years ago. Why the fascination still with the Titanic?
This was the exact question that drove the book and most of my research, trying to figure out why this one shipwreck among millions of shipwrecks in the world, there are about 3 million, according to UNESCO, captured this cultural fame and sits at this place as one of not just the most famous shipwrecks, but one of the most famous celebrities of anything in the world. I mean,
yeah, it's Titanic, amazing.
It is. The Titanic is one of the most popular Google search terms every day worldwide without flagging ever. And so it's bigger than the Beatles. It's bigger, you know, I like to say it's kind of got an economy to itself, like trying to imagine the economy of the color blue. I mean, it's limitless in its tentacles.
So why? Well, I mean, what were the factors you think that contribute to this iconic, you know, wreck on the bottom of the sea?
There is a reason, and I finally found it, which is, and let me just tell you a meandering way, which is to say there's very little about the Titanic that's unique, right? A ship that is big or was big in its day, there were many ships built bigger and bigger throughout the 19th and 20th century. Ships that carried rich people were very common. Ships that hit icebergs were also so common in the 1880s and 1890s that then in the Titanic's era, ships started to hit fewer icebergs and it was considered a success. And so the only factor that's really different about the Titanic that secured its place in the cultural zeitgeist for more than a century is kind of a weird quirk of math, of numbers, that about 1,500 people died, but 700 people lived. And those 700 were mostly young women and children who lived another 50, 60, 70 years telling and retelling the story of that night. And that storytelling kept the Titanic alive. Wow. Long enough yeah. for it to coincide with major advances in storytelling. You know, the advent of film, color film, mm-hmm. Talking film in the 30s and 20s, 30s and 40s. Eventually, book distribution that made it possible to distribute books wider to more people. And of course, you know, music and musical theater. Eventually, these high production films like A Night to Remember in the 50s and James Cameron's movie Titanic in the 90s. This was storytelling rooted in that survival rate, that there were 700 people's stories to work with.
So certainly the movies, right, Night to Remember, as you point out, and Titanic, and the book, Waterlord's book, A Night to Remember.
Sure.
All of that kept the story alive as well. But today, I want to make sure, it was the largest ship at the time, right? And it was its maiden voyage. That also contributed, didn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. Right. I mean, it was the largest ship and for a small period of time, and then there were larger ones. Compared right. to today, I mean, the Titanic would be one of the runts of the cruise industry. It's a tiny ship. But yeah, it was its maiden voyage. So it's got this kind of cultural story lore to it. But a lot of wrecks, if you consider that the Titanic sank, if everyone on board had died, it would have been an enormous story for a few weeks, maybe a month yeah. or two, and it would have faded. Right. And if everyone had survived, there'd be no story or there'd be no tragedy to it, you know? So the fact that it was right in the middle with death and survival, both in large number, is really unique among ships.
It was finally discovered. So it sank in 1912, right. April 15, 1912, discovered in 1985, right. 73 years later. Why did it take so long?
It took long because it was very deep, 2.5 miles deep. And we didn't have the technology until almost the 70s to look that deep. We can't see underwater. It's very difficult to make a map of the ocean floor because the waves that are sent down to make maps don't work in water. So the only way to see underwater is to hear with sonar, and you effectively have to drag a sonar rig behind a ship on this long cable, several miles long, and just back and forth, back and forth. And in the North Atlantic, which is not only really deep, where it gets really dark, right, the deeper you get, uh-huh. but also it has some of the worst weather on the planet. So, you know, it's really rocky for a ship on the surface to do that transect mapping. And so we didn't have the technology until, like I said, the 70s. And the guy who found it, Bob Ballard, in 85, mm-hmm. as you said, only found it because he had the benefit of government-sponsored technology that was created to find some old nuclear submarines that were also at the bottom of the North Atlantic. And the Navy basically told Ballard, we want you to go use our technology and find these two submarines. And if you have extra time, after, you can use the remaining days to search for the Titanic. And so he had 12 days to find the Titanic, and I think he found it on day 9.
Wow. Do you believe the Titanic will ever be raised from its berth at the bottom of the sea?
No. It's impossible. I ran this by a few engineers, you know, just how would you do it? And one of them said to me, it would be like trying to raise the Twin Towers after they fell. I mean, there's no structure to it. It's mostly just rubble that's been kind of collapsing on itself over the past century. But this question has kind of fantasized a lot of people for more than a century. And right. you know, people who I chronicle in my book who really have this grand vision of how they're going to do it. And, you know, they're going to use electromagnets, they want to use pontoons or syntactic foam or ping pong balls or wacky stuff. But a lot of them got a lot of publicity. I mean, written up in thousands yeah. of newspapers worldwide because that idea of raising it is really enticing. I mean, it's a fun thought experiment.
You certainly came across a cast of characters in writing your book, which I do want to ask you about. But before we do, aren't there other wrecks out there today where we could learn a lot more from them than we can from the Titanic, or there are more, maybe get more valuables out of them than the Titanic?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are, like I said, there are 3 million wrecks on Earth. The Titanic is not that unique among any of them. But yeah, there are a lot of wrecks that have a lot more kind of clues about the past. And there's 3 main reasons people go searching for wreck. There's scientists who are interested in the archaeology. And where they go is the Black Sea, because the Black Sea has the best preserved conditions, or the best conditions for the best preserved wrecks, deep water, low salt. So you could find old Greek and Roman era wrecks in the Black Sea. Then there's people who go for cultural wrecks like the Titanic, or, you know, the Lusitania, the Endurance that was found in Antarctica earlier this year. And then there's the treasure hunters. They're the third class. And they want to go, they don't really care about the ship. They want to know how much gold or silver or diamonds or teak or indigo or any of these kind of old valuable things. And they get big collections of investors and millions of dollars to go perform these kind of deep sea excavations. So all of them are worth finding for their own reason. But yeah, the Titanic is kind of like the Kim Kardashian of wrecks. It's famous because it's famous, and people want to be near it because it's famous.
Who does it belong to? I mean, can anybody just go down there and grab anything they want? I mean, is there any ownership?
Yeah, well, this is the question that powers a lot of the characters in my book, that for a long time, no one knew who owned it, that the people who paid out the insurance claim on the wreck on after the Titanic sank, Lloyd's of London, they washed their hands with it. They didn't want anything to do with it.
Whoever made it?
The White Star Line, once they got their insurance money from it, they didn't own it anymore either. And then, you know, the families of the victims, do they own it? They didn't want anything to do with it. So the main character in my book, a guy named Doug Woolley, claimed that it was his. And he just claimed it. And he was so successful in his claim that he was written up again all over the world in these newspapers as the guy who owned the Titanic. Today, it's a question that's gotten caught up in a lot of kind of court cases all over the world. The fact that it was a British-made ship, but it sank in international waters, but it was carrying a lot of Americans and people from other countries, you know, has given it this kind of squabble among the world's courts. But most courts have sided that no one really owns it, and it's a historic site that should not be disturbed.
Have questions been raised about the construction of the ship? I mean, and I watched a few videos after reading your book, including this one, I forget the name of the company, that takes these people down in this submersible. It glanced off the iceberg, right? It didn't hit it head on.
Right. It was on its starboard side, the right side of the ship.
Yeah. Weren't there questions about why the ship wouldn't have been built stronger?
Absolutely. This was a huge focus of the 2 major investigations that were done in the year after it sank. One in the U.S. by the Senate, and one in England by the British Board of Trade. And they looked at every single document, every single account of every survivor. And yeah, they noticed that the center of the ship, right in the middle, was built with really high quality steel. But the bow and the stern, the ends of the ship, were built with slightly lower quality steel because they figured, you know, the center is where the stress is when waves hit it or whatnot. And so had it been built with higher quality steel, you know, there's a belief that it might not have punctured the hull, that it might not have filled with water and sank. But again, these are like the looping conspiracies, the mysteries, the cultural swirl of this wreck that will never be decided. There's never a conclusion. They're just debate points that people debate online every day, everywhere in the world, you know, forever, really.
Well, no doubt in my mind that were that accident, that wreck, whatever, to happen today with any ocean liner, every single family who had anybody on board and lost their lives would have sued the ship line.
Oh, sure.
Did that happen back in 1912?
Yeah, there were lawsuits, there were insurance claims, and basically there was, you know, kind of major squabbles in the media over who deserved what and what kind of money. Interestingly, a lot of this centered on the behavior of the passengers. So you know, a lot of the men went down with the ship. Mm-hmm. There were some men who got seats on lifeboats, and they had to fight back in the media as to why they survived. You know, all these other guys died. What are you doing here in New York after? And so these squabbles, these legal squabbles about who is entitled to what kind of insurance money, exactly how big the total claim is, how it's divvied up. This was, I mean, you could imagine something like that happening now. It happened in those days. And that's right. Also what kept the story so alive and so in the media for so long.
I remember one story you tell in the book about one of the survivors, a man who was on deck, and he sees the lifeboat is about to go down and there are empty seats in the lifeboat.
Right.
And so he just jumps in, and there were no women and children around, right? So right. He just jumped in.
Yeah. And for the rest of his life, I don't remember his name, but he had to battle back these accusations of cowardice. Like, yeah. How dare you, you know? And you're right. The circumstances were totally reasonable. But the fact that the ship stayed in the media for so long kept just inconsistencies like that, you know, just eye-popping and culturally relevant much longer than they would have been on almost any other wreck.
So you mentioned some of the characters who've been obsessed, and I think that's the right word, obsessed with the Titanic, among whom Doug Woolley seems to be the greatest character. And you actually went to London to see him. Did he convince you that he's the owner of the Titanic and Doug has Woolley, all rights to it?
Well, Doug Woolley's a fascinating character, maybe the most fascinating person I've ever covered. I had read for months, I had been reading about Doug Woolley and the sense that he owned the wreck. And I couldn't find any evidence of him owning the wreck. But I kept seeing that he was labeled the man who owned the Titanic as a wreck. And yeah, so I wanted to find him, but all mentions of him kind of ended in the 1990s. And so I figured he was deceased. I mean, most of his work was in the 50s and 60s. And then I found kind of a journalistic clue that led me to another clue that led me texting with a guy and then another guy. And eventually I find Doug Woolley's alive. And I liken it in the book to basically trying to arrange an interview with the Pope, right? It was like so difficult through so many layers of gatekeepers. I finally get to him and he says, I want you to come to London. I want to talk to you. And this is a center character of my book. So I fly to London about a week before COVID starts, March of 2020. And I sit with Doug Woolley in his apartment that is, I would say to call him a hoarder might be generous because he has decades worth of shipwreck memorabilia, every inch of his apartment. And I'm asking him, you know, basically that same question. Do you have any evidence that you own this wreck or ever did own this wreck? And he says, yeah, it's all in the media. It's all in my clip file of newspaper articles. And I realized that he, you know, very similar to, you know, a character almost like Donald Trump, his main quality was that he could generate news coverage out of nothing, and then he could leverage it into more news coverage and then use the whole body of news coverage to rationalize some wacky claim he made and keep pushing it. It was a lie, but also Doug Woolley really believed it. And so he just kept pushing it and continues to push it to this day.
Is there any rule against, well, let me ask it this way. Can anybody who has the technology go down and just, you know, pick up some salvage pieces from the Titanic? You know, pick up a chair or a table or, you know, a silverware or something like that?
Right. Good question. And the caveat that you put in there is, can anyone with the technology? Most people don't have the technology.
Right.
In fact, the fact
but is that it, mm-hmm. it is it open season?
It's an open wreck site, but it is governed by several different sets of laws, some domestic U.S. laws, some international laws that have been litigated. Most of the artifacts have been picked up, and a lot of them, the biggest collection is owned by a company in Atlanta that basically provides them for traveling exhibits, right? You could see Titanic silverware, cutlery or teacups, picture frames, you know, furniture, cushions, whatnot, in a museum. A lot of field trip students go see these in Atlanta, which again fuels the next generation of Titanic course, fever. Right? But most of the easy stuff to pick up is gone. What's interesting is there's a lot of trash around there. More trash than ever were artifacts. Because, you know, for a submarine to go down, usually they need ballast. So they'll take these heavy chains, and then when they get down, they'll drop the chains so they could go back up. There are tours and cruises that go to the site where it sank on the surface. And, you know, people will throw over padlocks, you know, like those lovers padlock things. So there's, you know, thousands of those down there. It's kind of a trash dump site and grave site and cultural site all at once. So if you could, if you could have the, you know, if you did have the $250,000 to go down and see it, you'd see kind of a crumbling pile of rubble. That's basically what you'd see.
Now, your book, Sinkable, again, is not just about the Titanic. You talk about shipwrecks worldwide throughout history. Enough about the Titanic. Let's take a quick break and then come back and talk about some of the other famous shipwrecks and what the situation is today with our guest, Daniel Stone. And today's podcast brought to you by the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA, L-I-U-N-A. The good members of LIUNA, over 500,000 strong, they're the backbone of the labor unions in this country, doing construction work, building new schools, roads and highways, water and sewer system treatment plants. In the energy field, building solar panels and wind turbines and old-fashioned pipelines, and in the public sector, some 70,000 members of the Laborers Union, supporting working families, providing good jobs and good benefits for working families in America. We salute the members of LIUNA and their president, President Terry O'Sullivan. Thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back on the Bill Press Pod. Today, we're not talking political shipwrecks like Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania. We're talking real shipwrecks detailed with great sense of humor and great research by Daniel Stone in his new book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. After the Titanic, you mentioned a couple of them earlier, Daniel. What are the in your mind, the two or three most famous shipwrecks?
Easily the Lusitania and the Endurance. The Bounty, the famous kind of ship of Captain Bligh, you know, Mutiny on the Bounty. We have the Maine, right? Remember the Maine. There are wrecks of other countries that are culturally relevant that many of us in the U.S. have never heard of. There's a ship in Australia called the Waratah that is often considered Australia's Titanic. Very similar story. So those are the 1% of shipwrecks that are the ones that are famous that we've heard about. But there are hundreds of
thousands. Have they all been located?
Not all of them. No, the Waratah is still missing. There's a famous British one called the SS Arctic that's still missing that people are trying to find. The most valuable shipwreck of all time that was ever found is a ship called the Atocha, a Spanish ship that sank near Florida in the 16th century. But interestingly, there's an even more valuable wreck called the Flor de la Mar that was a Portuguese merchant ship that sank around Indonesia around the same era, believed to be carrying about $1.5 billion to $2 billion in gold. No one's found that one yet either. So there are a lot of valuable shipwrecks still waiting to be found. The question is the technology. Do you have the technology? Do you have the time? Do you have the investors who are willing to bet that you can find it and maybe lose their money if you don't?
And the object is to not only recover what valuables might be there, but to raise these ships and put them back into service? Has that ever happened?
Yeah, it has happened a couple times. There's a ship called the Great Britain that that sank. That was a kind of a British ship that sailed for about 100 years, and it sank about 80 years ago, and it was eventually towed. It was eventually raised and towed back to its port and is now the most popular tourist site in Bristol, England. A similar wreck called the Vasa, V-A-S-A, was a Swedish battleship that made it a full 1,000 meters before it sank on its maiden voyage in harbor, and was raised about 400 years later and is now Sweden's most popular tourist destination, seeing the Vasa. So these ships are given second life. The question really is, you know, what condition are they in? Can they be salvaged easily? And for a ship like the Titanic, that's so deep, 2.5 miles in extremely dark, cold, high pressure environment, the question was always no. The answer was no. You know, it can't be raised. The condition is so poor. And of course, once you get these ships above water, they start to rust way faster than they ever were below water. So their breakdown is accelerated.
You used the number before, 3 million shipwrecks?
Yeah, that's an estimate from UNESCO that studied.
That are out there, still down there?
Oh, yeah. And more every year. I mean, we lose fewer ships now than we did, you know, 200 years ago when ships were the only way to really get anywhere. But there, if you consider that this is how humans traveled around the world for thousands of years, the only way they crossed oceans. 3 million wrecks is the UNESCO estimate. And they admit that that's mostly a guess, that the number is probably a lot higher. It could be as high as 20 to 30 million when you know, consider every canoe, kayak, pontoon, speedboat that's ever sunk. So a growing number.
Is there any such thing as an unsinkable ship?
There is. I found one.
What?
There's a company in Boston, I forget the name, that makes and markets its unsinkable hulls. And basically, it's a ship that's kind of filled with a foam so that even if it breaks in half, and they show in their marketing how the ship can break in half, it'll still keep floating. So, but every other ship, I mean, any cruise ship you've been on, or, you know, any pontoon you've taken out on the lake, or a speedboat, I mean, they work on the basic principle of buoyancy, right? That they float because they're lighter than the weight of the water they displace, right? That's the basic scientific principle. And as soon as you change the equation, as soon as they become heavier than the water they're displacing, either by taking on water or, you know, they're loaded too heavy, or a storm hits them in a funny way, or in the Bermuda Triangle, there's an idea that there's methane vents that come up from the seafloor, bubbling methane, and that changes the weight of the water. And so the water becomes lighter and the ship becomes heavier and a ship can sink very suddenly. That's one of the theories of the Bermuda Triangle. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Just out of high quality steel, and you know, things that are welded together, right? You couldn't weld more than 100 years ago. So ships are built better. I will say ships are built a lot bigger. And when it comes to container ships, they're loaded a lot heavier. And so it's very dangerous to operate a container ship with maybe dozens of thousands of containers on board. Many of those, you know, the weight and ballast equation is very sensitive, and containers routinely fall off of ships. And a lot of those ships sink because of that.
You mentioned the 3 million. So, and you mentioned the Bermuda Triangle. Is there any, are they kind of evenly spread under the sea, or are there, is there any like major ship graveyard where more wrecks happen?
I actually have a heat map, I call it, of wrecks that show where most of them are. And no, they're not evenly distributed. They're very highly concentrated in places you would historically expect along major shipping routes. Most of them are in the Northern Hemisphere because that's where most people traveled. The vast majority are around Europe and especially England, which for hundreds of years dominated global shipping and shipping, you know, naval warfare. Was a major hallmark of the British Empire. That's how it reached all of its colonies. World War I, a lot of those wrecks are in the Atlantic. World War II, most of them are in the Pacific, but there are in the Atlantic also. So if you can imagine a map of the entire world, you have these kind of bright heat spots showing dense concentrations of wrecks around coastlines, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, and most especially around Europe and North America.
So living in Northern California, around the Point Reyes National Seashore, there were many wrecks there on the rocks. That's why they put the lighthouse at the end of the Point Reyes. And the word was, and there are many stories at that time when these ships would run against the rocks, that it was anybody could go and grab anything they wanted off the ship, basically, right? It was now, so if a ship sinks today, who has the rights to it again, or can anybody just go and, you know, collect whatever they can get?
Great question. And I delved pretty deep into this exact legal question because ships operate in this weird legal framework, right? They're built in one country, they're registered in another, maybe Jamaica. They're sailed to a third country carrying cargo from other countries and people from even other countries. So there's... Yeah. If a ship sinks in open water, deep water, international waters, there's often that question, and it comes down to what was it carrying and how valuable was it? Most ships don't carry, you know, millions of dollars of gold. That's an old thing. So now, usually the answer is nobody wants it, you know? And if it sinks in shallow water, it becomes a liability because it could be blocking other ships, or it could be leaking oil or any lubricants, you know, within the engine. And so there are these legal battles, not over who gets it, but who's responsible for it. And that's the vast majority of wrecks that go down around countries' coastlines.
And are there cases, I forget now, in the book where you mentioned, of people who scuttle the ships deliberately?
Yeah, there are scuttling stories, you know, during war, especially World War I, trying to scuttle your boat so the enemy wouldn't, you know, overtake you and, you know, get to keep your boats. But now there are professional salvage and scuttling companies that are basically hired by a state or a local government or a nonprofit agency that wants to sink an old ship to make a new coral reef. And they'll hire these companies to basically take a ship out of the water, clean it of all of its, you know, contaminants and its toxins. They'll smooth down the edges so that a diver maybe can swim through it, and they'll take it out to a predetermined place, and they'll, you know, open the doors, and they sink it in a very deliberate way. But they all say they have to sink it very quickly, because if you want a ship to go down in exactly one way, in exactly one spot, it's very difficult because of the current and the weather and the wind. And so it's very difficult work. Everyone I spoke to who did that work sounded tired. very tired.
Well, I must say, again, I read so many political books. I happen to come across Sinkable, reading a review of it. And I'm so glad I did because, again, I learned a lot. And it's just a fascinating, fascinating story. Unbelievable how many shipwrecks there are. And unbelievable that we are still so fascinated by the Titanic. I must say, though, no matter how fascinated I am, I'm not going to spend $250,000 to go down and take a closer look. I'll be satisfied with the video out there.
Right? I agree. I can't even be on a canoe without getting seasick, so I'm not going down there anytime soon.
Daniel Stone, the book is Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. And there'll be a link to buy the book, which I totally encourage you to do in the episode notes of today's podcast. Daniel Stone, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
And that's a wrap for today's podcast with Daniel Stone. Again, the name of the book is Sinkable, a fascinating book. And there's a link in the episode notes to today's podcast to get your copy of Sinkable. I think you'll enjoy it as much as I did. Well, now, folks, have a great weekend. We'll be back on Tuesday talking to another wonderful author, a legendary historian, Adam Hochschild, and his latest book called American Midnight. I got to tell you, this is the story of America between the years of 1917 and 1921, and you will not believe how democracy fell apart in those 4 years. The worst side of America maybe we've ever seen in terms of race riots and rounding up of dissenters and censorship, anti-Semitism, pure outright racism, horrible stuff, all under the so-called leadership of President Woodrow Wilson. Adam Hochschild lays it out in American Midnight, and he'll tell us all about it in our next podcast next Tuesday. So have a great weekend. Come back and see us Tuesday on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.